Hello, fellow Earth folks. I'm Annie Gigg, GYG, here on CFRU 93.3 FM and CFRU.ca, available wherever you are in the world. Warm welcome to Better Me, Better World, the show for growth-minded change makers, difference makers, and happiness makers. In previous episodes, we've been listening in on the fact-based time warp conversation between Annie Younger, a.k.a. Annie Y., at age 25, in the year 1980, and Annie Older, a.k.a. Annie O., 35 or more years older. I'm parking that conversation for this episode so I can share with you, while it's still fresh in my mind, my experience of traveling about with my son Liam in South America for a month. Specifically, we traveled through northern Chile, Argentina, southwest Bolivia, and southern Peru, primarily in the Altiplano, or high plateau, mountainous and desert regions. I dropped in on Liam's four-month hiking excursion through the Andes. It was by no means an R&R vacation. Our travels were characterized by pretty much continuous walking tours, rented car touring, van or bus touring. For the first couple of weeks in Chile and Argentina, while we had the luxury and flexibility of a rented vehicle, we bought groceries and pretty much cooked our own simple meals over Liam's camping burner as we were road tripping. During the latter half of our travel time, we bussed from destination to destination, primarily eating street food along the way. At day's end, we'd sleep in very modest accommodations, largely found through Booking.com, an hour or so prior to arriving. I've found it a challenge to process what exactly I felt and experienced, and I believe talking about it here will help with that, and ideally also give you a sense of stepping into, shall I say, an alternate world. Unless, of course, you're a resident of or visitor familiar with South America, in which case it's not an alternate world at all. But first, what is the world I'm stepping out of, away from? I live in southern Ontario, Canada, in a rural area, within a 15-minute car drive of an urban center. I'm accustomed to being surrounded by summer green on a gently rolling landscape, trees, grass, fields of corn and grains, green that gives way to golds and oranges and reds as summer matures and morphs into autumn, and grays, browns, and whites as winter settles in for four or more months. Water is abundant in rivers, streams, ponds, and lakes, and in my own small above-ground swimming pool. My house is humble by rural Southern Ontario standards, but more than adequate on its one-acre half-treed lot. What else did I step out of to head to the bottom half of the world, which is at the bottom only relative to the ubiquitous maps and globes of the Earth showing the North Pole at the top and the South Pole at the bottom? And relative to stats that indicate Southern Hemisphere countries to be much more commonly at the bottom of the economic wellness spectrum relative to Northern Hemisphere countries more commonly at the top. Otherwise, I'm pretty sure there's not a top and bottom to our planet relative to the universe as a whole. I digress, though. Traveling to West Central South America, I stepped away from large grocery stores and supercenters stocked with an abundance of and great varieties of food and non-foodstuffs. I stepped away from generally well-maintained paved streets and highways, primarily occupied by privately owned vehicles, largely driven according to traffic laws. Away from streets with well-marked names, stop signs, and traffic lights. I stepped away from the multitudinous billboards lining those highways. Away from cookie-cutter urban neighborhoods with private and public green spaces, recreational spaces, and walking trails. Away from restaurants serving free ice water as a matter of course. Away from wealth and privilege. But wait, wealth and privilege? Really? That surmising begs a question. What are the measures of wealth and privilege? Based on GDP, Ontario is the wealthiest province in Canada, which is about the 15th wealthiest country in the world, whereas Bolivia, one of our travel destination countries, is the poorest in South America based on GDP. So on that measure, it'd be accurate to say I traveled away from wealth. At first glance, my observations and conversations with locals would bear that out, but more on that later. What about privilege? To have privilege, explains Quora, means that you have access to certain benefits and opportunities that others may not have, often through no effort of your own. What effort did I ever have to make to benefit from free healthcare, to access Canada's outstanding education system? By the way, being one of the primary reasons why international students choose Canada for their higher education. Have I had to make any effort whatsoever to be protected by generally uncorrupt police forces? To have my health and well-being safeguarded by enforced building and property codes and health and welfare codes? I've had the benefit and opportunity of a well-paying career of my choice and am now enjoying the retirement pension I was privileged to accrue, supplemented by a government pension I invested no effort to earn. All these and so many more Canadian privileges, albeit tax-funded privileges, that I've benefited from since I came onto the scene as a newborn Canadian, I most definitely have thought of over the years as rights, as advantages I'm entitled to. But they're not. In the big global picture, they are privileges. They're favors, they're perks, they're bonuses. This came into stark relief for me during my travels. Yes, we Canadians do have rights embedded in our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, namely the fundamental freedom of conscience and religion, freedom of thought, belief, opinion, and expression, including freedom of the press and other media of communication, freedom of peaceful assembly, and freedom of association. Additionally, the Charter ensures our democratic rights, our mobility rights, our legal rights, and equality rights, among others. Does this mean they're perfectly insured? No. But I've been viscerally reminded to not ever again take our privileges and our rights for granted. At first glance, with my Canadian eyes, my travel observations were that the residents of these countries are generally significantly underprivileged relative to Canadian residents. But on further consideration, I asked myself, are they? We'll get to my second guessing on wealth and privilege in a bit. But first, here are those observations randomly presented, made over the course of a month of traveling by rented car, by foot, by tour van, by bus, which initially led me to believe that South Americans in the regions I traveled are generally poor and underprivileged relative to, shall I say, the average Canadian. Having said that, I acknowledge that there are populations and geographic areas of debilitating poverty and underprivilege in Canada. I observed during my travels within West Central South America that, in no particular order, their highways have almost no billboards or advertising along them, even near urban centers. Neither are there rest stops despite stretches of roads hundreds of kilometers across empty landscapes. There are very few private vehicles in towns and cities relative to public transportation vehicles, being car taxis, vans, and buses. These vehicles most often are not in, let's say, tip-top shape. In the rural areas, I did see personal vehicles parked beside houses. Most of the houses, especially in the rural areas, are very small relative to single-family homes in Canada, often appearing to be no larger than my living room. The vast majority of the dwellings in urban or rural areas are made of red clay, adobe style, red brick or stone, some with thatched roofs, using building materials from the ubiquitous reddish landscape. While it appeared most urban dwellings did not have private yard space, pretty well all of our accommodations had a pleasant inside, open-to-the-air, private courtyard area for relaxing and eating, often having colorful flowers and green plants. In contrast to, or perhaps because of, the monochrome, deserty landscape, intense colors abound in their locally woven textiles, clothing, and street decorations. Not infrequently, houses or businesses use old tires as decorative fencing. The tires might be painted bright colors. Some farmers employ oxen. Some village women wash laundry in rivers. Some kids play naked in the rivers. In northern Chile particularly, barred windows and doors are the norm, And most houses are behind high, gated stone or clay walls that line the streets and properties. Most of the urban roads are red dirt, red mud after a rain. While I did not see as many walls, gates, and window bars in Argentina, Bolivia, and Peru, the police presence seemed much higher there than in Chile and what I'm used to in Canada. Never once, however, was I concerned about criminal activities. It generally appeared that there are questionable building safety codes governing the construction of houses and infrastructure in rural and urban areas alike, and lack of health codes regarding the sale of street food. A 10-year-old study by ResearchGate called Comparative Analysis of Legislative Approaches Towards Street Food in Southern American Metropolises says, street food trade plays an important role in contemporary urban areas in South America. It represents a viable employment opportunity for vulnerable groups and ensures food access for a large part of middle and low-income working classes. Nonetheless, food safety is often at risk, and widespread informality undermines the development and legitimacy of the sector. In all the countries we visited, street vendors and outdoor markets were the norm and ubiquitous and numerous, whether selling cooked or raw food, beverages, clothing, textiles, souvenirs, hardware, household items. My limited in-store shopping experience led me to think their supermarkets are really glorified convenience stores. Although Walmart, under the name Leader, being somewhat similar in presentation to its Canadian counterpart, had a presence in Chile. Confusingly, the prices posted for the goods on the shelves in Leader were often not the prices rung up at the checkout. In other grocery stores, no prices are posted at all. I'm ashamed to admit we initially purchased most of our groceries at Leader in Calama, Chile, enjoying the relatively low cost and comfortable familiarity of the shopping experience. We experienced very long lineups in grocery stores, where the checkout is without scanners and done manually, at ATM machines, and at gas stations, where only the attendant pumps gas and sometimes washes your windshield. In the churches we visited, there were also long lineups for confessions. The waste disposal system throughout all the regions in which we traveled does not allow for the flushing of toilet paper in the toilet. The paper is disposed of in a basket adjacent to the toilet. There is almost always a nominal fee to use a public toilet, and as public toilets generally don't provide toilet paper, the fee includes a wad of paper and presumably the wages for the women handing out the toilet paper. Apparently, there is no licensing of dogs, as free-roaming dogs are everywhere, in the countryside, villages, towns, and cities. They generally appeared friendly, nourished, kempt. They seem to be respected by vehicle drivers. In certain towns and villages, there are no street signs, although the GPS gives directions using street names. Also, except in the larger urban centers, there are often no stop signs or traffic lights. At intersections in towns and villages, it seems to be each person for themselves. Constant horn honking is the norm. Seat belts are not used in taxis, vans, or buses. Most often, pedestrians do not have the right of way, except at the few pedestrian crossings in larger urban centers. It's a matter of making a dash across the street. In Bolivia, the state of repair of structures, sidewalks, roads, etc. was most pronounced, particularly in La Paz, the capital of Bolivia. As a pedestrian, caution had to be used at all times to not trip on sidewalks with deep gaping holes or jutting bricks. One tour guide shared that Bolivia suffers from severe corruption that impairs the flow of money down to benefit the people. Most of the country's income is from mineral mining by international companies from Russia, China, the US, Canada, and others, with little processing of raw materials happening within the country. Still in Bolivia, our hiking down steep rock steps along a vertical wall into a canyon, and our spelunking in a cave with 7 kilometers of passageways evidenced the lack of liability concerns in dangerous places by the National Park Department that provided our touring guide. In various bus stations, I questioned the quality of life of vendors of foodstuffs, bus tickets, etc., inside the terminals, as the decibel level was extremely high. Numerous competing vendors from early morning to late night would call out the sale of their wares or services in very loud voices. In a similar noisy vein, on public transit, multiple riders would listen to their cell phones without use of earbuds. Due to salt and minerals in the soil over most of the area we traveled through, trees cannot grow. We were there at the end of the rainy season, but regardless, the landscape was brown and red. Grass was almost non-existent. Only low shrubs and bushes, or nothing at all, grew in the desert landscapes that resembled rover images from Mars. Our travels didn't include Amazonia, which obviously would be a totally different, lush, jungly, green landscape. We experienced torrential downpours and magnificent thunderstorms, almost always in the evenings. In a couple of instances, locals say they were unusually heavy and attributed to climate change. Power outages during storms were not unusual. In many places, there are no culverts under the roads. Instead, there are dips in the road to channel water flowing over the road. Flash floods across a mountainous landscape barren of trees are common, and so are the associated rock and landslides that block roads hugging the edge of mountains. Rural properties often had, apparently irrigated, gardens whose greenness showed in stark contrast to the surrounding red-brown. Farming was done in smallish plots on mountainsides. Quinoa thrives abundantly in the desert landscape, along with unfenced domestic or wild llamas, alpacas, donkeys, sheep, and goats. Shepherds minded their flocks. Our nighttime accommodations, however humble, with perhaps one minor exception, were extremely clean. As the saying goes, we could have eaten off the floors. Likewise, the sidewalks and streets in the urban centers were kept very clean, with property owners and proprietors sweeping and washing the public spaces adjacent to their premises. Although there are no scoop the poop signs anywhere, neither was there evidence of hordes of dogs living on the streets. So that sums up my top-of-mind observations I made in my travels of, shall I say, differences from my corner in Canada. There were other minor things, like their corn cobs are really big with much bigger, paler kernels than ours. There is no free water served with food, no public drinking fountains, no pepper to accompany the salt. After all, we were in a very arid part of the continent for the most part, an area that's known for its extensive salt flats, but no pepper flats. The Salar de Uyuni in Bolivia is the world's largest salt flat, or playa, at over 10,000 square kilometers, or 3,900 square miles in area. After a rain coats the brilliant, white, unending flats with a thin layer of water, the flats become a magical, otherworldly place, reflecting the sky perfectly, so people out on the flats appear to be in the sky. Sunsets and starry nights are twice as beautiful there. The salt flats are only one example of the amazing natural wonders of the regions we explored. We spent a good part of our time in the Atacama Desert, being the driest desert in the world outside of the polar regions. Its colors and starkness, moon-like landscape, and widely variable rock formations were captivating. Likewise, the numerous colors in the Andes in Argentina and Peru, attributable to the presence of various minerals in the rocks, were stunning. The night skies from the high plateau were breathtaking. The treeless, majestic Andes were always on the horizon, or we were traveling through their deep valleys. Seeing dormant volcanoes, active geysers, hot springs, and dinosaur footprints in the rock of the barren landscapes made it easy to visualize the world there 100 million or so years ago. And, of course, the widespread Inca ruins of agricultural terraces on mountainsides, temples, businesses, and houses on mountain tops took us back to a less distant past, to the time of the Inca Empire from 1438 to 1533. the empire, centered in modern-day Peru and Chile, with about 12 million inhabitants at its height, was the largest empire in America throughout the pre-Columbian era. Geographically, it was also vast, being approximately 4,000 kilometers or 2,500 miles in length from the northern to the southern tip of the continent. It's easy for me to describe the natural landscapes of West Central South America and the awe they invoked, but I return now to the more challenging task I've set for myself. How do I describe the feelings I took away regarding the people who live there, their everyday life, their culture? Physically, as I anticipated, their heritage is a mixture in varying degrees of European, predominantly Spanish, and indigenous ancestors, some almost entirely of European ancestry and some almost entirely of indigenous stock. But that's not it. Did I sense happiness in the people? Is it even fair for me to ask myself that question after only 1 month of traveling about in four countries, engaging as much or more with fellow travelers as with locals? Can I be objective in assessing my feelings? Upon my return to Canada, I made the comment to a family member that it has to be a very long, unrewarding workday to sit on a three-legged stool or on the curb out in the elements from morning until evening as a street vendor, continuously trying to capture the attention of passersby to buy your goods, competing with all the other vendors. In response to my comment, I was asked, "And was it better for you, commuting an hour each way through urban traffic, to sit in the artificial climate of an office for 8 hours, 5 days a week, working for someone else?" That caught me up. The vendors didn't particularly look like they were enjoying their work, but then I probably wasn't wearing a smile for 8 hours sitting at my desk either. I could consider the matter more objectively by referring to the World Happiness Report that's put out each year for 150 countries. As an aside, for 7 years running, Finland's been deemed to be the happiest country in the world, with the other three Nordic countries following thereafter. In 2024, Canada ranked as the 15th happiest. Chile comes in at 38th, Argentina 48th, Peru 68th, and Bolivia 73rd. By that measure, I can say Canadians are significantly happier than the residents of the countries I visited in South America. But still, there's something nagging at me about this. And this is what it is. There's an isolated, very scenic village called Iruya, of about 1,000 inhabitants, located 300 kilometers from Salta, the capital of Salta province in Argentina. The village of red adobe buildings is nestled against the mountainside above the Iruya River at an elevation of almost 3,000 meters. It's a long, nerve-wracking trip to the village along a narrow dirt road switchbacking up mountainsides with no guardrails and precipitous drops at the edge of the road. It takes about 2.5 hours to travel 50 kilometers and necessitates traversing watercourses with shifting gravel beds and unknown water depth three times. But the drive was worth it, and not just for the scenery. We readily found comfortable accommodations for the night and spent our short time in the village hiking up to a high point for a best view of the stunning valley and ambling about the village streets. But what has stuck with me is the experience of that evening. Our hotel room overlooked the central village square. It was comprised of a covered, open-air court for soccer or basketball games. Adjacent to that was a playground of swings and steep metal slides and teeter-totters, looking like the playgrounds I recall as a child in the 1960s. Around these recreational spaces were benches, and beyond the benches, a cobblestone-like street ran around the perimeter of the square, and fronting on the street and closing the square were homes and businesses, such as our hotel. As late afternoon edged into a calm, mild evening, the square gradually filled with the happy laughter of little children in the playground. A game of basketball got underway, with teenagers calling out to each other, cheering. Elderly men sat on the benches, enjoying each other's company. Mothers chatted in groups, keeping their eyes on the playground. Police officers walked about, engaging with the folks. As dusk grew deeper, first the moms and the little kids departed, then sometime later the players and men. Then all was quiet for our sleep. For me, there was something very warm and fuzzy about this, perhaps induced by lack of internet and geographic isolation. Whatever the reason, this tableau spoke of real, honest, impromptu community at its very best. There was a feeling of wealth and privilege in the most important non-monetary sense in that little village square up on the mountainside that late summer evening. The same feeling was evoked in me by the simplicity I saw generally. The small adobe house in the rural area with the donkey and sheep nearby, a man plowing a patch of field with oxen, women washing their laundry in the chocolate-colored mountain river, little kids skinny-dipping under the falls. I had the impression that they may be barely eking out a living, but also, I'm pretty sure, I was feeling a little yearning for the seeming uncomplicatedness of their lifestyle. I think somehow a life might be very rich when unburdened by accruing, caring for, maintaining, and wanting an abundance of material possessions. Perhaps it's a privilege to be free of that. In the cities, we bought the street food I was warned against consuming by the travel clinic back home. It was simple food, most often a variety of chicken, rice, potatoes, corn, in a deep-fried pastry of some sort. Sometimes, when not eating on the run, we sat at a makeshift table and bench on the sidewalk beside the street vendor's grill with the locals using real plates and cutlery, washed by the vendor between customer uses with a rag and water in a small pot. Dogs watched from close by but never attempted to get at the food. Was it luck or a strong constitution or a cholera vaccine or an exaggerated health clinic warning that I never got sick? It was a common sight to see locals enjoying conversation and affordable food, sitting together at the vendor's sidewalk table, eating with the reused cutlery and mismatched plates. This, too, spoke to me of simplicity, of community, of connection richness. What a privilege to enjoy such companionship. I saw very modest homes clustered close together in urban centers. I saw streets alive with vendors calling for the business of passersby. I saw markets where shoppers would go every day for fresh produce and meat. I heard commotion, and beneath it all, I noticed connection. The country folk likewise seemed to me to display connection to their land and their animals, leading their small flocks along the mountainside, their fields frequently a size that can be worked by hand, devoid of large agricultural machinery. Of course I'm generalizing, perhaps even rose-tinting, as there were places of large corn, potato, and quinoa fields and vineyards in the wine-producing area of Cafayeta in Argentina, where I'm sure the agricultural practices would be mechanized, similar to what I'm familiar with in Ontario. But the thing is this, I'm now sure of it. Yes, I did observe a general lack of wealth and privilege measured against Ontario, Canada monetary standards and global GDP indexes, but I also saw a simplicity and community connectivity that I believe has been largely sacrificed by nations in their status climb to being a developed or industrialized country, formerly known as a first world country. In fact, C2Cjournal.ca reported that, and I quote, a survey by Statistics Canada in mid-2021 found that more than 40% of Canadians feel lonely some or all of the time, with the problem worst, as one might imagine, among single people and those who live alone. While it may be tempting to simply blame the COVID pandemic for this tsunami of social dysfunction, experts were fretting about a loneliness epidemic and its effects long before public health officers forced isolation upon us. It's not just that it's a drag to feel lonely. The effects can be catastrophic for your health. Loneliness is associated with numerous unhealthy behaviors like smoking and physical inactivity, worrisome symptoms such as poor sleep, with a long list of ailments and conditions from high blood pressure and cardiovascular disease to a weakened immune system. One study found the risk of premature death from social isolation was greater than that from obesity, which is scary in itself since obesity increases the risk of heart disease, diabetes, and some cancers. End of quote. And also, end of my attempts to process my feelings from the sights, the sounds, the tastes, the touches on my South American travels. Suffice it to say, I feel greatly enriched for the experience, and I'm still wondering who exactly enjoys the greatest wealth and privilege. Thanks for listening in as I shared and processed my travel experience. I invite you to once again become flies on the wall as we return to the self-discovery conversation between Annie Younger and Annie Older by tuning in to the next episode of Better Me, Better World. I'll be back same time next week, same place here at CFRU 93.3 FM or CFRU.ca. The shows are recorded, so alternatively, have a listen when it works best for you. Until next time, be you. I'm Annie Gigg.